Chapter 23. Sherman's Path, Mount Rollins, New Hampshire. Mel breaks away from Tim's sweet touch, and yes, it's all wrong. The two men are smiling, but there's no friendliness or humor in those gazes. And the slacks, dress shoes, and button front shirts they're wearing, with no knapsacks or even water bottles, are all wrong for being up in the mountains. Tim looks to the two men, and then to Mel, and whispers,
"Guess we got caught, huh?"
She slowly treads water and whispers, "Tim, get the hell out of here. Now, get to the other side of the pool, get into the woods, run." Tim is confused. "Mel, what's the problem?" The two men are coming closer, still smiling. She knows. When Dad was first running for Congress, and some Rotary Club guy was speaking at a Bonefish restaurant, a newspaper reporter covering the event asked a bored Mel what she thought, and she said, "He talks too much." Which was true, but it got her into trouble with Mom at the time. Mel always had a knack for seeing people for what they really were. And these two aren't hikers. They're killers. The taller man stops.
"Mel Keating, please get dressed and come with us. And your friend as well."
Tim says,
"Who the hell are you guys? Why should we go with you?"
The other man pulls out a pistol. Oh God, Mel thinks, and the water feels so much colder.
"Does that answer your question?"
the nearer man asks, still smiling. Mel raises her voice, trying to be strong in front of Tim.
"Don't you want to avert your eyes as I get out?"
He shrugs.
"Ho ho, Mel Keating. I've seen much worse."
Besides registering a fear that's making her legs and arms quiver, Mel Keating is rip-roaring 100% pissed off at herself as she climbs down the mountain with the two armed men and Tim, hair still wet, feet damp in her boots. When they suddenly appeared, Mel knew right away that something wasn't right, even beyond their lack of proper outdoor clothing. It was their faces. Smiling and open, but Mel caught their eyes, saw the eyes of hunters. Growing up in Texas, she knew that most of her family were hunters. And when Dad was in the Navy and some of his buddies came by for a visit, just before they were about to go off on a mission, she saw that same look. Always moving, flickering, evaluating, ready to strike out. If they hadn't been in the water, her suggestion, and had been on the trail, she would have shoved Tim into the woods, and they would have started running, taking advantage of the tangled brush and trees to escape. But in the water, there had been no escape. Just the humiliation of climbing out of the pond, getting dressed under the men's stares, and being forced back on the trail, and then taking a separate path down the mountain. Tim is in front of her, his face pale whenever he turns to look back at Mel. And in front of him, quickly descending the trail, is the younger man. The older man is right behind her, and as the younger man slows down and gently negotiates a stretch of broken boulders, Mel says to the older man, "Why are you doing this?" The man smiles, and his accent isn't as heavy as before.
"You know."
"But my dad, he isn't the president anymore. If you're looking for..."
"Mel Keating, you have no idea what I'm looking for now, do you?"
"But you don't have to do this," she says, thinking furiously. And Tim looks back, eyes wide with fright. And she goes on and says, "Just let us go."
"Allah wills otherwise, I'm afraid."
Thinking hard, Mel says, "Please, Islam is a religion of peace, isn't it? Prove it. Let us go. If you have a message, a concern, or a complaint, I'll pass it along to my dad. He can see it gets to the right people." The man doesn't say a word, and then bursts out laughing.
"Oh, you young, ignorant girl. What you don't know about me and Islam could fill a container ship. But I have been a patient teacher for many, many years, and you and your father have so much to learn. And I have so much to teach. I have been waiting a very, very long time for this.
He gently caresses her neck with the muzzle end of the pistol.
Now please, move, he says. All of this discussion is quite interesting, but I have a feeling you're trying to... What is it? Stall? Yes, stall, in case we meet other hikers coming up this trail. As you hope for a distraction or an escape. Please. We did not plan this much and travel this far to allow a stray hiker or two to delay us. Melanie Keating, do start moving.
Tim is still staring at her. Fear-wide eyes, filled with moisture. And Mel wants to take a moment and say, Sorry, Tim. Dating the president's daughter didn't turn out the way you hoped now, did it? Another shove from the pistol. She starts down the trail, slowing her pace, and that's instantly noticed. The older man says,
Move quicker, Miss Keating, or I will lose patience and leave your head on a trail sign.
Chapter 24 Huntsman Trail, Mount Rollins, New Hampshire. The minutes slip by quickly, and with each footfall, Mel knows it's up to her to get herself and Tim away from these men. If she were stuck in a snowstorm in these mountains, or washed up ashore on a deserted main island, there's no one she'd rather have at her side than Tim. But this is different. She thinks of all the hard young men, and some women, she met when Dad was in the Navy, and later, when he campaigned for Congress. She heard the tales, sometimes eavesdropping when she should have been in bed, and she learned a lot about what was really out there beyond the borders and oceans. She'd trade anything to have one of those campaign volunteers here now, instead of sweet, innocent Tim. Hell, her mom, who was at Dad's side from the beginning and worked in the nasty, backstabbing world of higher education, would be thinking like Mel right now, looking for options, a way out. The woods thin. The trail widens. The dirt parking lot comes into view, and she looks and looks. Damn. Just one vehicle on this trailhead, a couple of miles away from where Tim parked his car. A black Cadillac Escalade. Oh, if only there were two or three cars here, full of hikers, maybe some rough, strong football or rugby players from the college. It's still up to her.
Step faster now, the older man behind her says.
They're on the dirt surface of the parking lot. Tim stops, and he takes two steps to her, whispering,
It's gonna be okay. I promise.
Tim tries to keep things together as he looks over the two armed men, thoughts roaring through his mind at the speed of Class 4 rapids. Like being in a fast-moving and dangerous river, you observe the conditions and think through the best survival options. Damn it, he thinks. He should have listened better to Mel back in the pool, gotten up and raced away. Sure, running naked through the trees would have hurt like hell, but at least he could have eventually found someone, maybe someone with a cell phone, to put out the word that Mel Keating was being kidnapped. Back at the pool, Mel was the president's daughter, sensitive to danger, and not Mel, the typical Dartmouth student. Mel steps forward and says,
All right, look, whatever you want, whatever you need, it all comes down to me, not my friend here.
She points to Tim.
Take me. Leave him behind.
Tim can't believe how brave and calm Mel seems to be, and he takes in her words and thinks, All right. Maybe we can do something here. In a side pocket of his knapsack is a folding knife that he can quickly unclasp. Back at the pool, putting the knapsack on, he had quietly unzipped the pocket. If he can get these two to let him take the pack off, he could get into that side pocket and... The older man lowers his pistol and says, You would want that? To leave your companion behind and go alone with us? Mel nods as the younger man moves closer to Tim. Might work. Keep on talking, Mel, he thinks. Keep on talking. He says,
Hey, guys, my back is aching. Mind if I take my knapsack off?
Mel says,
Yes, That's what I want. Leave Tim behind. I'll go with you.
Tim starts to loosen his straps. Desperate, but if he can get the knapsack off, he can toss it at the guy with the gun and then go after the other guy with the knife. Slice him or stab him, anything to hurt him, and Mel and he can start running through the woods. Mel says,
What do you say, sir? Will you do it? Doesn't it make sense?
The older man says, It certainly does. Tim is thinking,
Okay, let's do this thing.
Young man, he says, Do you promise to stay here if we leave? Do you?
Tim thinks, Jesus, it's going to work. This guy is letting his guard down.
You bet, Tim says. I promise.
Mel thinks, I'm making an impression. Maybe he'll do just that. Let Tim go, and in a while, he'll be with the cops and giving them a description of these two armed guys, the Cadillac, and what direction they were headed. This just might work out. To her shocked surprise, the older man asks Tim if he would promise to stay behind. Tim looks relieved.
You bet. I promise.
The older man says something quick. Arabic, perhaps? And then in English says,
Very well. We will leave you here.
Thank you, God, Mel thinks. It's going to be all right. The younger man steps over, sticks the end of his pistol in Tim's left ear, and Mel watches in horrified silence as Tim tries to squirm his head away from the touch of the metal, and there's a loud report. A spray of blood. Tim grunts, collapses upon himself onto the dirt parking lot, shudders, and quickly dies.
Chapter 25 Huntsman Trailhead, Mount Rollins, New Hampshire. It took some talking on his part and spending money for a day babysitter, but Clem Townsend is one happy guy this morning, with his wife Sheila by his side as they drive up the dirt road to the Huntsman Trail, which leads up to Mount Rollins. 10 years ago to this day, the two of them hiked up here and he popped the question on the summit, holding a nice engagement ring he had bought at the Walmart over in West Lebanon. Of course, she said yes, and this mountain and this trail have always had a special place in their memories, and every anniversary, they make it a point to repeat the climb. 10 years and 3 kids later, Sheila still looks pretty good, even with a few extra pounds, and Lord knows he thinks he's added a few more himself.
Clem, look out!
He rests the steering wheel of their old Subaru Forester to the left as a large black SUV roars down the narrow dirt road, coming within inches of sideswiping them on the right side. He calls out, Jerk! As the Subaru's left wheels drop into a shallow drainage ditch. Sheila holds onto the dashboard as their car goes thump, 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 and then manages to get back onto the dirt road. He stops, breathing hard.
Christ, that was close, he says.
You okay, hon? Sheila nods.
What a clown. He came so close I thought he was going to rip off the side view mirror.
Clem eases up on the brakes and drives slowly for another minute or so, and they come out into the dirt lot for the trailhead. And as Clem parks near the wooden trail sign with yellow lettering, Sheila says,
Oh, look at that. Those idiots left a pile of trash behind. No wonder they were in a hurry.
He looks over and freezes. He and Sheila own a little gas station and convenience store in the nearby town of Spencer, where he's a volunteer firefighter EMT. He knows what he's seeing, and it's not trash. Clem switches off the engine. Sheila, get your cell phone out. See if there's service up here. Sheila fumbles in her purse as he gets out of the Subaru into the cool late morning. At the start of the trail is a crumpled form, and he quickly walks over, saying, Hey, you okay? You okay? Young man, eyes open in surprise, wearing khaki shorts and a Patriots t-shirt, crumpled up on his side, knapsack secured to his back, and the side of his head a bloody, oozing mess.
Sweet Jesus,
Clem thinks. Sheila is next to him, her shaking hands holding her Galaxy cell phone, and she says,
Clem, we got service.
Call 911. Tell the dispatcher where we are and there's a man killed here. She makes the call, and Clem stays away from the body, knowing what to do, what not to do. The young boy is dead, and there's nothing to do for him. No reason to go up and check the body now, is there? Leave the boy be, along with any evidence the police will find. He hears Sheila on the phone, her voice even and calm. Good, strong woman, he thinks. Lucky to have her. But something else is odd. Another knapsack dumped on the ground about 6 feet away. Another hiker? The shooter. Was this guy on the ground trying to steal that knapsack, tussle, and then somebody took out a handgun? Sheila says, hear that? A faint sound of a siren. Somebody's moving fast, he says. Sheila says, dispatcher managed to get a hold of Donnie Brooks out of Troop F. I bet that's him. Clem is pleased. This part of the state has little or no town police departments, meaning the state police and the county sheriff are often the first responders. Because of their little store, he and Sheila know every sheriff's deputy and state trooper within a 50-mile radius. Like the trooper driving a dark green Dodge Charger coming into view, light bar flashing as the cruiser comes to a skidding halt. Donnie Brooks is at the wheel, and Clem sees him use his cruiser's radio to sign off at the scene. He quickly steps out in the standard trooper uniform of dark green shirt and tan trousers, and his face is wound up with concern and energy as he comes up to them, putting on his round campaign-style hat over short blonde hair. He's in his late 20s, bulked up around his shoulders, and he moves in a hurry. Donnie gives the body a quick view, staying a few feet back. Clem, he says. When did you find the boy? About 10 minutes ago, Donnie, he says. Sheila and I were coming up here for a hike. Anybody in the area? See or hear anything while coming up here? Sheila says. We almost got run down by a big black SUV. Son of a bitch nearly ran us off the road. Donnie is still staring at the body. He pulls a small notebook out of his left shirt pocket, along with a pen, and starts taking notes. How long from when you saw the SUV and when you found the body? Sheila says, about 3 minutes. What kind was it? Clem says, I don't know. Sheila says, Cadillac Escalade, that's what it was. Damn thing nearly hit me, nearly ripped off the side view mirror. Donnie says, did you get the license plate? No, I didn't, Sheila says. Sorry to say, I didn't see what state it was. The state trooper checks his watch, and from observing troopers and other cops working over the years, Clem knows what Donnie is doing, estimating how far the Cadillac has gone since the two of them nearly got hit. Donnie toggles his shoulder radio mic and says, Dispatch 114, put out a bolo for a black Cadillac Escalade departing the area heading to Upper Valley Road. Possible witness or suspect. Alert departments in Permort, Montcalm, Spencer, Monmouth, and Leah on the bolo as well. Contact Sergeant Wagner. Have him report here. There's more radio chatter back and forth, and when there's a pause, Clem says, See that extra knapsack dumped there? Don't you think that's odd, Donnie? The young trooper nods. Yep. Noticed that right after I rolled up. Gonna take a look at it? Should wait for my supervisor to show up, but shit, might be helpful. Donnie circles around the knapsack and then puts on a pair of latex gloves, squats, opens it up. Clem eases up to see what might be in the pack, and out comes a water bottle, 2 granola bars, a dark blue sweatshirt, a pair of wool hiking socks, and a tan wallet. That's something, Clem says. Sheila is next to him, close enough for him to hear her breathing. The trooper opens the wallet, pulls out what looks to be a student ID, and Clem peers closer and is stunned at the photo and the name of a pretty young blonde woman, Melanie R. Keating. Oh, shit, Donnie says as more sirens sound off in the distance. Sheila says, That That's President Keating's daughter. Clem can't say a word. This is going to be one anniversary to remember.
Chapter 26. Northwestern New Hampshire. Mel Keating is trying to ease her rapid breathing, which is hard to do since her arms and legs are bound by duct tape, her head is covered by a cloth hood tied around the base of her neck, and her mouth is taped and filled with a wadded-up piece of cloth. Luckily, her glasses are still secure on her face. Part of her is quaking in deep horror and shock at seeing Tim shot dead in front of her, snuffed out before he was even old enough to drink, blasted away in a dirt parking lot by two terrorists. Tangos, she thinks, her eyes streaming tears, using the familiar military slang for terrorists. Killers. Scum. The kind of people Dad fought when he was in the teams, and later, when he was president. Mel is stunned at her college classmates' ignorance and apathy about the real world, and she's learned to keep her mouth shut during late-night hangs, when her fellow students would drone on and on about how the real roots of terrorism were poverty, despair, and inequality. One night, she pointed out that Osama bin Laden had come from a wealthy Saudi construction family and was certainly not penniless or oppressed. And boy, she never made that mistake again after putting up with an hour of listening to how ignorant, unfeeling, and privileged she was. The hood is canvas, smelling of grain. She still fights to keep her breathing steady, and she is desperately trying to listen in on her two captors as they speed along. Her. They wanted her. The president's daughter. But why? Dad's been out of office for nearly 2 years. No power, no influence, no way to pick up a phone and meet their demands. Shut up, she thinks. Focus. A minute ago, the SUV she's in got off the dirt road and swerved left onto a paved highway. Think. Listen. On a paved road. Damn it, she thinks. You should have been paying attention. Toughen up, girl. Keep calm. Keep breathing through your nose. Stay relaxed. Don't think of sweet Tim. Don't think of his being murdered. Don't think. Listen. The hum of the tires on a paved road. They're still going on pavement, Upper Valley Road. Pay attention. The SUV stops, backs up, back on a dirt road. Start counting. 1001, 1002, 1003. She's being transported, taken to a hideout, a remote place for her kidnappers to keep her secure and send out a ransom demand. By counting and keeping track, she can retrace her travel at some point, and the SUV stops, moves around, back on a paved road. Okay, how many seconds was that? 10? 11? The SUV goes in a circle, stays in a circle, circling, and back on a dirt road. Now, a paved road. Tears come to her eyes. Those guys up there, they're good. Confusing her, making sure she can't keep track of shit. The tears come faster. Mel thinks, okay, you two are good. But I'm pretty good myself. She takes a deep cleansing breath, remembers paved road, dirt once more. And she starts counting again, as her kidnappers speed along the smooth pavement. If they think they've kidnapped some typical college kid who's going to demand a pillow and safe place, Mel is relishing the chance to prove them oh so very wrong. Chapter 27. Northwestern New Hampshire. Sometime later, Mel feels the SUV stay on a dirt road for a good length of time, and she resumes counting one more time, going 1001, 1002, and keeping focused. The tears have stopped. No time for tears.
Her legs and arms are cramped. Her mouth is dry, raw, with the cloth stuck inside. And she's wondering how long it will be before Tim's body is found. The sudden shot of a pistol. The look of shock on Tim's face. The spray of blood out in the air. Her ears pop, going up in altitude then. The SUV slows, stops, right at 63 seconds. Remember that. The forward doors open and shut. Murmur of voices. The rear hatch opens, and she dimly senses sunlight through the cloth bag. Hands grab her, and she's lifted up with ease, and she fights not to moan, groan, or flail around. She won't give the bastards the satisfaction of seeing her squirm in fear. No, she won't give them that. She's moved around, and she senses she's in a house, because she can hear the footsteps of her two captors, and the squeak of a door opening, and now they're on steps, and Mel is gently lowered onto a bed. Hands move across her, and she recoils at the touch. But they are brisk, formal, tearing away the duct tape and using a razor, scissors, to cut through and remove other swaths of tape. The bag is last. It comes off and she blinks her eyes through her glasses several times. And then the younger guy comes to her, and he's got something in his hands, a little bottle of vegetable oil. He smears a bit on the edge of the duct tape across her mouth, and then gently tugs, and repeats the procedure several times, until the tape is removed without much pain. For real? They kill Tim and kidnap her, and they're concerned now about hurting her? The guy's older companion looks on, staring. The tape is gone, and she works at the cloth with her tongue. But the guy who pulled the tape off, he does the same with the wad of cloth, and she says, ugh. And then he offers her a drink of bottled water. She swallows, and then spits out a stream on the guy, catching him right in his smug face. You bastards, she yells out. You miserable, evil killers. You will. The older man with the bushy eyebrows steps closer, and something about his dead eyes stops her. She takes a breath, now really scared. Not wanting to look at him, she gives the room a quick glance. A concrete cube, with no windows and the only exit a heavy metal door. She's on a small, made bed. There's a lamp in the corner. Small table and chair bolted to the floor. A chemical toilet. That is it. The older man says, here you are, Melanie Keating. And here you will stay, unless your father agrees to my demands. She wants to spit at him again, but she doesn't have the saliva. My dad is tougher than you think. Don't you idiots know that? Do you think he's going to give in to your demands? The older man smiles a weary smile, gestures to his companion, who goes to the door and unlocks it. He says, he may be a tough man, as you say. He gently pats her on the head, like a prized pet or toy. But is he a tough father? He quickly leaves the room. The door closes behind him and is locked, and Mel is the loneliest she's ever been in her life. Mel curls up on the bed, hugging herself, praying, God, please have Dad get me out of here. Please. A few minutes pass, and then she stops the prayers, stops hugging herself. Mel sits up, wipes at her eyes. All right, she thinks. You've had your cry. Maybe Dad will find her. Maybe not. But no more crying. Time to start thinking and planning. Mel thinks, if I'm getting free, it's going to be up to me. Nobody else.
Chapter 28. Lake Marie, New Hampshire. After my phone call from Deputy National Security Advisor Sarah Palumbo and the grim and unsatisfactory discussion with Agent David Stahl, I'm trying to vent my frustrations on my late morning chores. Not much else an ex-POTUS can do in these circumstances. Earlier, David gently recommended that I stay inside for the day, and I equally gently told him no. Well, maybe not so gently. What I'm looking to do is clear out the brush and saplings and old growth that strangled this old stone wall, set here probably 2 centuries ago. It'll look nice, especially after I get the land rototilled and plant some grass. I stand up, stretch my back, try to enjoy the view, try to quiet the concern in my mind. Hard to believe with all these forests, but these trees are relatively young. Centuries ago, most of the trees here were cleared out by the earlier settlers and farmers. And then when cheaper and more fertile land opened up in the West, after the Native Americans were nearly wiped out, of course, many farms were abandoned, and the trees reclaimed their birthright. And why New Hampshire? I grew up in Texas, lived for a number of years wherever the Navy sent me, returned to Texas, but decided to lay my head down here in the Granite State, which threw me a lifeline after I got my ass kicked in the Iowa caucuses by my rebellious Vice President Pamela Barnes. The people here gave me a solid victory in the famed first-in-the-nation primary. I like and honor loyalty. I fumble for my iPhone, check the time, and do a quick selfie video with my recent work in the background. "Hey, Sam, here's my daily update," I say. "Making progress. In a couple of months, it'll be all cleared away. Hey, maybe you and your crew can come here and do a dig. Who knows what you might find. Love you. We'll call you tonight." I switch off. Send my daily selfie to Sam's email account with its bu.edu address, and look forward to getting back to work. In the time Sam's been at BU, we've made it work, with us spending time together usually every other weekend, and for longer stretches during the summer, holidays, of course, and a few events at Dartmouth with our daughter Melanie. It's an odd relationship, I know, but the Ozzie and Harriet family of the 1950s is long gone. I go back to the stone wall, and a figure emerges from behind the rough rocks, wearing camouflage clothing, black gloves, a sniper's veil, and holding an SR-16 CQB-556mm assault rifle. My muscle memory kicks in and I grab it in my right hip, where there is nothing. No weapon at all. Damn, Chatter is right after all. I'm about to toss the handsaw at the figure when it suddenly lowers the weapon, tears off its sniper's veil, and the sweaty face of a young blonde woman is revealed. Secret Service agent Stacy Fields holding an agency-issued weapon. And she speaks into her wrist microphone. "This is Fields. I've got Harbor at the Old Stone Wall. Repeat, Harbor is at the Old Stone Wall." I swivel to the sound of a racing engine. The Boston Whaler is rushing in my direction. The two agents no longer carrying fishing poles but carrying weapons. And there's a flow of water at the bow, and I flash back to my Navy days recalling that boat is sure moving fast. It's got a bone in its teeth. Something is seriously wrong. That Chatter warning from Deputy National Security Advisor Palumbo is right on the mark. Another engine roars louder, and a bouncing, mottled green Yamaha four-seater UTV is racing toward me. Agent David Stahl is at the wheel wearing a Kevlar vest, and two other Secret Service agents, Ron Dalton and Paula Chin, are riding with him, also wearing Kevlar vests, and holding out their own SR-16 CQB-556mm assault rifles. The UTV skids to a halt, and Agent Fields grabs the waistband of my shorts and the collar of my T-shirt and says, "Sir, we've got to get you to safety now, please." The Boston Whaler swerves to shore, and the two armed agents jump out of the boat, quickly push through the water, kneeling down on the shoreline, looking out to the lake with weapons at the ready. I drop the handsaw, and Agent Fields propels me to the open rear seat in the UTV. I'm bundled in and buckled, and the UTV roars in a half circle as I'm pushed down and a Kevlar bullet-resistant blanket is tossed over me, and I barely adjusted to my cramped position when the UTV's engine roars with speed. Something is seriously wrong. I bounce and rattle, and then the engine roars louder, and there's a quick skidding halt, and the heavy blanket is tugged off me, and I'm unbuckled from the rear seat, and I'm practically carried to the two-car garage adjacent to my lake house. The left garage door is lifting up, revealing a reinforced concrete bunker with a heavy metal door in the center. My lake home safe room. There's a blur of motion and orders of go, 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 and the door is opened from inside by Secret Service Agent Nicole Washington, and I'm carried and propelled with the other armed agents around me. I'm pushed inside. Agent Paula Chin brings up the rear, standing at the door, SR-16 CQB assault rifle up to her face, blocking any outside view or aimed weapon as the heavy door is closed. And I think that this is what they mean by that simple phrase, putting one's life on the line. The door closes. She steps back. I sit down on a plain black leather couch. David, I quickly say, what's wrong? What do you know? This room was built before I moved in, and it's designed to keep me and Mel and Sam, if she's here, protected in case of any external threat. There's a self-contained air system, food, stored water, and a tiny bathroom. And about the only thing that could breach this little cube inside my garage is a tactical nuclear weapon being dropped on the roof. There are couches that fold out into beds, and a small dining area with a refrigerator and a stove, and it's about as cheerful as a prison cell. David, I call out again. There's a communications console set up at the other side of the room with CCTV screens monitoring various parts of my property. From one screen, I see the end of our dirt access road. The omnipresent New Hampshire State Police cruiser has shifted position to block the entrance, and two state police troopers are kneeling behind the cruiser, automatic weapons in hand. Agent Nicole Washington is seated at the console, earphone and mic on her head, and Agent Stahl is standing behind her, speaking quietly but firmly. Contact the field offices in Burlington, Concord, and Boston, he says. We need more bodies here, stat. Then get on the secure line to D.C. We need to alert them, and we need the FBI to... I yell out, Agent Stahl, what the hell is going on? He quickly turns to me, and he no longer looks like the happy subordinate from earlier after his defeat in our canoe race. His face is hard set, full of fury and concern, and it's the look of a man with a mission, a man in charge, despite having a former president sitting before him. His words come out, each one hitting me like a hammer blow to the gut. Stahl says, I'm sorry to tell you this, Mr. President. Your information about the threats was correct. Mel has been kidnapped.
Chapter 29. Lake Marie, New Hampshire. Secret Service Agent David Stahl is originally from Bakersfield, California, and after serving in the Marines, three tours in Afghanistan, he joined the Secret Service, and over the past 10 years, he's worked his way up to the Presidential Protection Detail. But despite all the training, all the simulations, all the practice drills, he feels as though the entire weight of the Secret Service and Homeland Security is on his shoulders as he reacts to the evolving situation and makes decisions that he knows years from now will be examined, critiqued, and second-guessed. So the hell what, he thinks. This is what he signed up for. And job one at this very moment is to keep Harbor in place before the ex-SEAL operator in front of him grabs a weapon and breaks out of here to hunt for his daughter on his own. Keating's body is tense and coiled, a warrior who needs to strike out and strike out now. David knows the feeling well. Keating says, tell me what you know. Sir, I'll make it quick, and please, we've got work to do to locate your daughter and protect you as well. Keating's face colors. Don't insult me. I know that. Go. Stahl says, personnel from Fish and Game and the Grafton County Sheriff's Department were en route to Mount Rollins. They just didn't get there in time. Your daughter's knapsack was found at the Huntsman Trailhead. The body of her friend, Tim Kenyon, was found nearby, shot in the head. No ransom note as of yet. The former president nods, face pale. David says, the New Hampshire State Police were the first responders at the murder scene. They've transmitted a bolo for a black Cadillac Escalade that was seen speeding away from the trail. Roadblocks are being set up, and we're asking for airborne units from the Vermont State Police and the New Hampshire State Police to begin an airborne search. We're... Keating holds up a hand. I'm keeping you from your job. Get to it. But is there anything else I should know right now? No, Mr. President, Stahl says. And to himself, as he turns back to Agent Nicole Washington and the procedures that need to be followed and the notifications that must be made, he admits that he's just lied to Matthew Keating. Because Mel's kidnapping is Agent Stahl's fault, and not just because of this morning's warning. 2 months earlier, he is in his small upstairs office in the renovated barn on the Keating property when his desk phone rings. He picks it up. Stahl. And Agent Washington is on the other end. David, I've got Director Murray on the line, she says. Are you in or out? He rubs at his tired eyes. He's been working on the staffing schedule for the next 3 months, and as always, he's shorthanded. He's always shorthanded, having to ask the detail here to work mandatory overtime, which is a quick way to burn out good agents and send them to the private sector. He's the special agent in charge of the detail, and he should have a deputy special agent to take some of the burden, but that position's been unfilled for months. I wish I was out, he says. Put her on. Faith Murray's the deputy assistant director in charge of the presidential protection detail, and she gets right to the point. Stahl, what the hell are you doing up there in New Hampshire? He slowly sits up straighter in his chair. My job, he says. What's the problem? The problem is that you're violating both policy and procedure by providing security to Mel Keating, she snaps. You know how much trouble you're in? Stahl says, we're not providing protection to Mel Keating. That's not what I've heard, she says. Stop the bullshit. What are you doing? He rubs at his eyes again, looks out the small window. There's music and laughter and a volleyball net as Mel Keating is having a cookout with a few friends, Dartmouth students. Right now, Stahl wishes he was their age, worrying only about upcoming lectures and not getting a ball spiked in your face. There's also a dull ache inside of him from missing his wife, Hannah, who these past 5 years has been dead from leukemia, leaving him a solitary widower with no time for or interest in re-entering the dating pool. Field training, he says. I don't want the detail here to get stale, so we do exercises where we're surveilling and following individuals. It made sense to have them follow Mel Keating. Does she know? No, ma'am. And her father? Again, no, ma'am. Then knock it off, Murray says. There are approved training modules. Follow them. And Mel Keating is old enough that she doesn't need protection. Ma'am, what is it? He grits his teeth for a moment. Her father is a former president and a former SEAL operator. It makes sense that he has a number of enemies out there, lots of enemies. You protect him, and that's it. It's not enough. I say it is, she says. I'm late for a session with the Secretary of Homeland Security. Anything else? Make it quick. He wants to say no, it's not enough, damn it. And if you had worked more in the field, out in the rain and the snow, working long shifts and being alert all the time, you would know. Instead of going to training seminars and retreats and schools, being promoted the bureaucratic way instead of coming from the field, you would know, deep in your bones, how exposed and vulnerable Mel Keating is. Hell, he thinks, even this compound is vulnerable. At the homes of other former presidents, operations centers are always at an off-site building, so the entire protection detail isn't a single target in one place. But the Barnes administration and its congressional supporters have hacked and slashed the Secret Service budget. Some D.C. commentators said it was revenge for President Keating's decision to contest his vice president's election challenge, and the lack of agents and resources here has been the result. Not at the moment, Director, he says, and she hangs up on him. Stahl is looking at the CCTV screens and says, get Towler and Wren back out on the water. Nobody gets within 100 yards of the place lakeside. Got it? On it, Washington says as she starts quietly speaking into the microphone. And as they've done before in training simulations and drills, the two of them work in sync, keeping focused on the job and nothing else. Protect Harbor at all costs. Even though right now, he feels as though he's failed the president and his kidnapped daughter. Chapter 30. Lake Marie, New Hampshire. Inside the safe room, a soft murmur begins as the expensive and classified HVAC system kicks in, pumping fresh air into the space and filtering any biowarfare pathogens that might have been released on the property. Stahl shakes his head. Stop whining. Do your job. Roll back the outer perimeter, Stahl says. Set them up at the secondary defensive line. Phones are ringing. Static-filled radio messages are frantically crackling through small speakers. Agent Chin is behind a thick Kevlar and metal mobile barricade, gently lining up spare magazines on the floor for her automatic rifle, a gas mask nearby in case there's an attempt to break through the door. Mel Keating has been kidnapped. Is that a one-off or the start of something else? Do the terrorists want Stahl to try to evac Harbor now, before reinforcements are in place? Take him out by an RPG or an ambush squad when Keating's on the move? Or is there an assault team now moving through the woods, heavily armed and with penetrative explosives, to lay siege to the safe house? Washington says, the state police SWAT team is responding, going to the pre-approved staging location. Stahl nods. If Keating was still serving as president, Stahl would have a shitload more resources at his fingertips. Armored vehicles, limousines, helicopter and aircraft within driving distance, and the Secret Service's counter-assault team, which could take on and win a firefight against any standard army squad in the world. Washington says, we've got 3 agents inbound from Burlington, 4 from Concord, and 8 from Boston. Stahl says, who's in the house? Emma Curtis? Our sacrificial lamb, Stahl thinks. The bulk of the agents are either here in the safe room or have been pulled back from the Keating property to set up a more defined and local defensive perimeter. But an agent has to be on duty at the main house to receive and brief those agents and other law enforcement officers as they arrive to beef up the compound's defenses, because no one is getting in and out of the safe room until it's time for Harbor to evacuate, which isn't happening anytime soon. But it also means that in the wood-framed and undefended house, if an attack comes, Curtis is on her own. Washington says, Vermont State Police is offering their SWAT team. Tell them thanks and reach out to Concord. Another quick second, and Washington says, Secretary Charles is on the line. Secretary of Homeland Security Paul Charles, Stahl thinks, used to run the Florida Highway Patrol before the new president picked him to run Homeland Security, which has had oversight authority over the Secret Service ever since 9/11, and he's utterly useless. Tell him we're busy, Stahl says. He glances around the room. Nobody is saying a word. Everyone is focused on their area of responsibility, sliding into their pre-planned and pre-trained positions. Keating is sitting on the couch, jaw set, staring right and hard at Stahl. Stahl has to look away. Washington says, David, we've caught a break from the FBI. Nice change of pace, Stahl says. What is it? 8 members of their hostage rescue team are doing training at Hanscom Air Force Base in Massachusetts, she says. They can be in the air in 5 minutes. Stahl says, we'll take them. A low voice that he can barely recognize comes from behind him. David. He turns, and Keating is standing up. 2 points, he says. What's the status of my wife? Professor Keating is still at the archaeological site in Hitchcock, with about 6 grad students and volunteers. Has her protection arrived yet? Keating asks. Maine State Police should be there by now, Stahl says. There's a National Guard armory within 2 miles of where she is. That's where they'll take her. Keating nods. All right. Stahl is desperate to get back to the task at hand. Check the status of the perimeter defense. See if he can get 2 more agents on watercraft out on the lake. Work up a plan to eventually get Harbor out of here and someplace larger and easier to defend. Stahl says, Sir, what's the other point? Did I hear right? And there's an HRT team coming here? By helicopter? Yes, sir. They'll be here in under an hour. Keating nods, and Stahl sees the look in the man's face change from that of a protectee to one now in charge. Good, he says. Once they arrive, we're getting on that Black Hawk and getting the hell out of here.
Chapter 31. Hitchcock, Maine. It's late morning in the small fishing village of Hitchcock, Maine, and Boston University professor and former First Lady Samantha Keating is on her sore and aching knees, looking down at what is slowly, oh so slowly, being uncovered by 2 of her grad students from a meter down in the dirt. She's sweaty. Her hands are encrusted with dirt. There are blisters developing along both thumbs. Her clothes smell, and she is in her own form of paradise. In so many campaign seasons past, she got trapped at some political event in an ill-fitting gown, eating tough chicken and cold potatoes, attempting small talk with some unctuous man or woman running for office. But not now, not here. This is where she belongs. This is where she thrives. Not in that damn plastic and artificial arena of politics, but here, on the ground, in the dirt, slowly uncovering stories and secrets from the past. A young grad student, Cameron Dane, is gingerly sweeping away more of the fine soil with a camel hair brush when she says, "Professor, do you see this?" "Do you?" An open tent has been constructed over this part of the dig, protecting the uncovered soil and artifacts from the strong main sun. But Samantha can easily see what's coming into view. Curved red tiles made by humans and from Europe. "Yes," she says, her voice rising in excitement. "Yes, I do." Paul Juarez, another grad student, says in awe, "Professor, that's Basque. No doubt about it." Samantha's smile widens. "Nice to know a gamble sometimes pays off, right?" The students laugh as more of the red tile is revealed. "Jackpot," she thinks. Despite all the poorly written and distributed books in grade school and high school that talked about the early French and English explorers and settlers to these shores, the real history is more complex and puzzling. Up in Newfoundland and along other provinces in Canada, there are archaeological sites that show that Basque fishermen from the 1400s, long before Columbus stumbled his way into the Caribbean, were fishing the astounding wealth of cod and whales that clustered around these shores. There were always suggestions and theories that the Basque could have gone farther south, here to Maine, and if any evidence were discovered, it would forever change the history of New England. Such history has never been found. Until today. "Careful there, Paul," Samantha gently says to Juarez. "These tiles haven't seen the light of day for more than 600 years. Another 6 or so minutes won't make a difference." The Atlantic Ocean's waves hitting the rough rocks and boulders provide the predominant sounds here at the site in Hitchcock until the noise of a racing engine reaches her ears. Big deal. Right now, she doesn't care about the 21st century and its technology and squabbles. And God, she certainly doesn't care to think about all those wasted hours and days and weeks being first lady and pretending to care. This is her time, her place, and she imagines what it must have been like to have been one of the Basque fishermen back in the 1400s, sailing here, finding the rich schools of fish, unbelievable wealth, far from their traditional fishing grounds in France and Spain. Not coming here to conquer or make an empire. No, just coming here to work the waters. One of the site's volunteers, an older gent named Picard, wearing jeans and a gray sweatshirt, runs up to the tent. "Professor Keating, there are two men over there looking for you." She says, "Tell them to go away. I'm busy." Samantha continues to stare at the emerging tiles, to find a Basque fishing station here, in Maine. The headlines that would produce, the papers she could write, maybe even a book-length history. 2 years ago, People magazine profiled her as she started fieldwork here, and since then the news media has left her alone. But to have them pay attention to this? Now? The volunteer is insistent. "Professor Keating, they're..." Samantha holds up a hand. "They can wait or go away, their choice. Paul, you're doing good work there." In the distance and coming from the small dirt parking lot, she sees two men running toward this tent, running past the two other smaller tents and 3 screen sifters where dirt is checked for artifacts, heading right at her, both wearing dark gray suits with white shirts and neckties, and she slowly stands up. Both men have shoulder holsters. It's as though a cold chunk of this main dirt has just sunk into her chest. "Cameron," she says. "Yes, Professor Keating," the student says, not looking up from the history being unearthed in front of her. "Something's going on," she says. "Until I come back, you're in charge." Cameron lifts her head, and Samantha walks out into the open sun, and the red-faced man holds out a leather wallet with a gold badge inside. "Mrs. Keating," he gasps. "Detective Sergeant Frank Courtney, Maine State Police. You've got to come with us." "Matt," she instantly thinks. "Oh, Matt, what have they done to you?" "Let me get my bag," she says, and then the other officer's voice freezes in her place. Mrs. Keating, we don't have time. We need to get you out of here, he says. The briefest and most horrible of pauses. Your daughter Mel has been kidnapped.
Chapter 32. Northwestern New Hampshire. Mel is not sure how long she's been in the basement cell, but it feels as though it's been hours. She's thirsty, hungry, and cold. And she's untucked a blanket from the bed and has wrapped it around herself. She sits on the bed cross-legged, thinking and listening and looking. Not much to see. Earlier, she explored the small room, and when the door was open, she noticed it has exterior hinges and is secured by a keypad. The bed, chair, table, and lamp are all securely fastened to the floor. The same with the chemical toilet. There's no external power cord leading from the lamp, and the light cannot be turned off. At one point, Mel was tempted to shatter the light bulb, make the sharp glass some sort of a weapon, but she quickly realized that it would plunge the room into utter darkness, and she shivers at that thought. She moves on the bed, still trying to think things through, trying not to remember. Tim's funny way of imitating the host of The Daily Show. Tim sticking up for her that time in the African history class. Tim's sweet habit when they were sitting together at lunch or driving or hanging out and studying of occasionally just reaching out and gently rubbing her neck. Not in an attempt to get her into bed or get her clothes off, no. Just a sweet way of saying, "Hey, I'm here. Let me know if you need anything." She wipes at her eyes. Quiet. It's too quiet. She gets up off the bed, stands on tiptoe, cocks her head to see if she can hear anything from upstairs. Nothing. No footsteps, no talking, no doors slamming. Her cell is pretty well insulated. She takes off her glasses because she knows from long experience that for some reason when she removes them, when her bad eyesight is given no corrective, her hearing skills seem to improve. But nothing changes. She can't hear a thing. Mel sits down, takes stock. Her clothes, and that's it. Her hiking boots were taken off back when she was bundled into the SUV, so there's no chance of using the bootlaces to make some sort of garrote to strangle one of the two tangos. Like that would happen. Thin gold necklace around her neck. A gift from Dad on her 14th birthday. And a gold ring on her right hand that once belonged to Mom's grandmother. She gets up and goes around the room once again. No ventilation system, so there'll be no taking off a grill and crawling to freedom like in Die Hard or some other movie. A clicking noise, coming from the other side of the door. Mel moves to the bed but doesn't sit down. No, she thinks, brushing away the tears from her eyes, her thoughts going to Tim again. She's going to stand up to these two sons of bitches. The door opens, and the older man comes in, followed by his companion. The older man is holding what looks to be a small video camera, and the other man holds out a newspaper. Both have pistols holstered at their sides. The older man says, "We will shortly provide you with a meal and water, but this meal comes at a price." A quick outburst of Arabic, and the newspaper is thrust toward her. A copy of USA Today. Mel keeps her hands at her sides. The man with the video camera sighs.
"This will be quick and requires nothing on your part, save you hold out the newspaper to prove to your father that you are alive on this day. If you do not cooperate, then my cousin will encourage you. It will be painful, and at the end, you will still hold up the newspaper."
His words, spoken so well and plainly, like an instructor gently explaining the difference between John Locke and Karl Marx, still hit her cold and hard. "Is that it?" she asks. He nods.
"Yes. I won't even ask you to speak. Just hold the newspaper for a few moments, and then we will leave, and then you will be fed."
She holds out her hand, takes the newspaper, and blinks back tears. Then unfolds the paper and holds it under her chin.
"Very good,"
the man with the camera says, and he brings it closer, and Mel feels her fingers begin to tremble. The paper is shaking. She's ashamed and scared, and won't this fool hurry up and finish and leave? "There," he says, lowering the camera. He reaches over and takes the paper from her hands.
"You will soon be fed."
"Lucky me," she shoots back. "What's on the menu? The two of you look like you couldn't even use a microwave." The older man says,
"It will be satisfactory, I promise."
"And after that?" He moves to the door, his companion right beside him.
"Up to your father and Allah. Soon he will receive this video and a message from me."
"What are you asking for?" He opens the door, smiling.
"For something your father will never be able to provide."
The door starts to close, and Mel says,
"Wait! Just wait! Can I ask a favor?"
The man stops in the doorway, pauses for a moment.
"You may ask."
Mel points to him.
I'm afraid of guns.
"I'm sorry, that's just the way it is. The next time you or your friend come in, please, will you leave your guns behind?" The man smiles and nods.
"No."
He and the other one pass through the opening, and the door is securely locked behind them. A few minutes later, she's back on her bed, cross-legged again, blanket over her cold shoulders, remembering and thinking. Remembering a time a few years back when Dad became president, and there were those weird couple of weeks when they moved into the White House, and there were meetings and tours and briefings, and there was one Secret Service agent, David Stahl, who pulled her aside and said,
"Mel, you're going to have 24/7 protection here and wherever you go, but there may be a time when there's a mistake, a screw-up or an overwhelming assault. You might be on your own. Let's talk about what you can do then."
That was an interesting meeting indeed. And while she was scared shitless at some of the things Agent Stahl said could happen, she was also proud that even though she was only a teenager, he was treating her as an adult. She remembers everything he said. And now she's thinking of what just happened and how Mom and Dad are going to react when they see this video released later, and what that terrorist jerk is going to say and demand. Mel manages a smile. One thing, though, is that he seemed to accept what she said back then, that she was afraid of guns. That is bullshit. Dad taught her how to use firearms when she was in first grade. And since then, she's fired everything from a .22 Ruger pistol to a fully automatic M4 assault rifle. She knows that. But that jerk doesn't know that. The little victory heartens her.
Chapter 33. Lake Marie, New Hampshire. Agent David Stahl looks pretty pissed and frustrated, and I don't blame him. I'm proposing to violate every piece of procedure and training he's learned over the years, and it's my job in the next few seconds to break through that training. Trying to keep my voice on an even keel, I say, "If Mel's been kidnapped, that means there's going to be a ransom demand." Part of me silently breaks out in prayer, thinking, "Please, please, please let there be a ransom demand. Please let her be alive. Please, God, help me get my girl back." Because I know I have enemies out there with long memories, and right now, a ransom demand is our very best option. I won't let myself imagine anything else. Stahl says, "Perhaps, Mr. President, again, this might be a ruse to get you moving and vulnerable, open to an attack." I go on. "Perhaps. But if there's a ransom demand, then the FBI and Homeland Security come in along with every law enforcement agency in New England. Samantha and I need to know what's going on and what the demand is, what options are out there. Am I right, David?" His lips are pressed together, his jaw is firm, and he nods. The other Secret Service agents in this safe room are doing their best to ignore us. What a change. What a difference. Last night I barbecued cheeseburgers and hot dogs for this crew. Later did my best to beat them at poker. And now that cheery and happy crew has morphed into who they really are, trained men and women ready to kill to protect me. That means meetings, phone calls, briefings, and video conferences. I move a hand around. Which can't happen in this concrete box. I need to get out of here, David, and now. But Mr. President, I... I interrupt. I'm not the president. Pamela Barnes is. I'm just the former POTUS with no power, no influence, no responsibilities. You and everyone else here are sworn to protect me, and I can't thank you enough, but I am not going to sit here wrapped in cotton and wait. Sir, we're getting other assets up here to safely transport you to a more secure location. How long will that take, I ask? We have a helicopter coming here crewed by the FBI. Let the HRT team deploy, and with everyone departing the chopper, you and I and maybe another agent or two will slip aboard and out. His face is still stern-looking, and I'd hate to be under his supervision and called into his small office in my house for a reaming out, but one way or another, I'm getting out of here. We stare at each other. He breaks first. Where would you go? Manchester Airport, I say. From there, Reagan National, and then the Saunders Hotel over at Crystal City. Why the Saunders, he asks. My re-election campaign still has an office there, still wrapping up paperwork and other crap from the FEC. It's already been vetted by your folks. It's across the river from D.C. How are you getting there? I say, I need my iPhone from the house. Stahl shakes his head. Can't open that door, sir. Yes, you can, I say. Get the on-duty agent from the house to bring over my iPhone and my go bag up in the first closet of my bedroom. I'll make the necessary arrangements to secure a flight. Another heavy few seconds pass. This will mean my job, he says. I still have some friends in D.C., I say. I'll do my best to help you. He stares, and without breaking eye contact with me, he says, Nicole. David, the agent at the comm console, says, contact Emma, he says. Get Harbor's iPhone and go bag over here. All right, she says. My face relaxes some. And David's expression seems to lighten as well. David says to Nicole, then contact the HRT. Once the team disembarks, they're taking on two to the Manchester airport. All right, she says. I nod. All right, I say. A tiny triumph, a tiny step toward finding my daughter, but I'll take it. Chapter 34. Lake Marie, New Hampshire. 6 minutes later, I'm in a corner of the safe room while my detail continues to work the phone and other communication systems. There's a lot of calm talk, phones ringing, and more crackling radio messages. I scroll through my contacts list on my iPhone, furiously thinking and hoping, seeing what friends are out there. Truth is, there are not many. One thing I quickly learned in politics, and it was one hell of a learning curve indeed, is that there are very few people you meet who will become true friends. Most folks you meet in politics, no matter how open the smiles and how deep the compliments, just want you in your office. And when you're out of office, they fade away. But a few stick around. There. Trask Floyd. Once in the teams like me, he found a second career as a Hollywood stuntman and then a third career as a wealthy actor and movie director. And we became friends when I was a congressman and he needed help from the Texas Film Commission. The phone rings once, twice, and a young male voice answers. Trask Floyd's phone? I say, this is Matt Keating. I need to talk to Trask. Once upon a time, my name would allow the famed White House switchboard to get me connected with nearly anyone on the planet with access to a telephone. But no longer. Sorry, sir, he's not available. Where is he? He's setting up a shot and we're already behind schedule, so... I find my command voice. Son, you get Trask Floyd on the phone in the next 60 seconds or you'll regret it for the next 60 years of your life. Go. The phone goes silent. A few long seconds drag by. Mel, I think. Oh, Mel, where the hell are you? Who's got you? The phone comes to life. Matt, Trask says. I don't know what you just said to Tommy, but he looks like somebody just drained a quart of blood from him. I say, where are you? Vasquez Rocks in California, he says. Getting ready to blow up shit and film same. California, I think. Damn, I was hoping he'd be closer. I say, I need your help. You got it, Matt. Good old Trask, no questions, no demands, no inquiries. What do you need? I need an aircraft at the Manchester Airport, New Hampshire, to fly me and a Secret Service agent to D.C. Trask says, when do you need it? 5 minutes ago? Shit, Trask says. From my phone, I can hear voices in the background on the other end. It's sounding like people out there at his filming location want his attention. Mr. Floyd, Trask, we're losing the sun. Hold on, Trask says. He seems to hold the phone against his chest, and there's a loud, muffled stream of curses. and then he returns to the phone and says, "All right, you've got it." I close my eyes in relief. "Don't you want to know what's going on?" "No," he says. "I need to make some phone calls, and you need to do what you've got to do. God bless you, Mr. President. I've got your back." Minutes later, I hear the low hum of a nearby helicopter, the noise even penetrating the concrete, and I'm by the door, go bag in my hand, and Agent Stahl is standing next to me, also holding a black canvas bag. In his other hand, he holds a Sig Sauer pistol. From the console, Agent Washington says the Blackhawk's on the ground. The door is unlatched, and Agent Chin pulls it open. Agent Stahl goes out first, and I'm right behind him, and in front of us, on the lawn, going down to a sandy beach at the lake shoreline, a Black Hawk helicopter is on the ground, rotors still roaring. A line of black-clad, helmeted, and booted members of the FBI's famed hostage rescue team come out, and David and I run by them, heads bowed down from the heavy propeller rush, bits of gravel and dirt hammering at us. God, so many memories come back to me about boarding helicopters just like this, heading off to dangerous and desperate missions, but none are as desperate as this one. Agent Stahl gets into the helicopter first, helps me aboard, and a crew chief slides the side door closed, and we make our way to the webbed seats and sit down, me across from him. We both put on headsets, though I have nothing to say, as the Black Hawk lifts up over the forested peaks of this part of New Hampshire. And I look down, anger and fear pounding through me, thinking, Mel might be down there. Mel might be right below us. What to do? I shift my go bag so it's within easy reach, knowing what's in there. Spare clothes, sneakers, water, energy bars, and cash, among other things. As POTUS, the only weapons I ever came near belonged to the Secret Service or its CAT team. Yet in my go bag are a Sig Sauer 9mm P226 pistol and a disassembled Colt M4 automatic rifle with a TAWS 32 thermal sight and plenty of ammunition for both. I'm an ex-POTUS now, and I'm also a father who's willing to go anywhere and kill anyone involved to get his daughter back.